Chapter 26. It took Miller about 40 minutes to find the best speed, one fast enough for them to make their goal in plenty of time, and slow enough so the ride wouldn't kill them. Through cautious experimentation, he had found an automatic pilot of sorts, one that would keep them on the same heading until he toggled it off or touched the joystick. After that, it got a little easier. It would have been a daunting trip in a conventional boat, and a long one in a plane, as he well knew. But they skimmed easily along at a rate that he estimated would get them to their goal with about 10 hours to spare. In fact, the little hovercraft was so speedy that he'd chosen an extremely conservative course, one that would guarantee they hit the coast somewhere in California or Baja, Mexico. Without charts, it was hard to be sure. But it would have been harder to miss a coast that size if you knew its general direction, and that part was easy. Miller reasoned that when he hit the coast, you should find it easy enough to follow it northward, or south in the unlikely event that he'd gone too far up the coast, until he came to the familiar landmarks of the Channel Islands and then San Francisco Bay. With or without modern landmarks like the Golden Gate Bridge, he was sure he would find his target. And thanks to this wonderful little ship, he would have time to spare.
"We'll make it. Knock on wood," he said.
He looked around for a piece of wood to knock, found none, and instead gave three quick raps to the armrest of his chair. He had never really been superstitious, but then he'd never flown a submarine to California to save the world either, and the homey little gesture made him feel better. Mara looked up at his rapping and smiled. She said something in her wonderful, lilting language, but Miller couldn't make out even a single word.
"Sorry,"
he said, shaking his head and smiling ruefully. Mara smiled back and held out her amulet. She pointed to several of the beads, and he examined them.
"Wood,"
he said. She nodded and gave him the beads, three miniature knocks, then held it out for him.
"Thank you,"
Miller said, and tapped softly on the wooden beads. As he did, he realized that he hadn't been this close to Mara before, except when they were facing some kind of danger together. Now, with the ship running smoothly and his hopes rising, he had time to look at her. She was wearing her woolen shift. It had been meant to be worn under her druid robes, but with those long gone, it would have to do as an all-purpose garment, at least until they got someplace where they could find new clothes. He was again surprised to see how young she looked without the ponderous robes, and how attractive. He'd become used to her face, had always found it pleasant, well-formed. But now he felt himself looking at her in a different light. Dressed only in the flimsy shift, she was quite clearly a very beautiful woman. And in spite of his recent time with Yuki, he found himself powerfully attracted to her. But what were the rules about sleeping with druids? He had no idea. Were they celibate? Would she feel obligated to kill him if he made any move in that direction? There were so many things about her he didn't know. So many things no one would know. The world over, about interacting with all these other cultures. And what would happen tomorrow when he got to Bodhi headquarters and fixed things? Would she be instantly whisked back to her own time? Would she be trapped in the present, whatever it might be, with him? How would he feel about her if she became a permanent obligation? He kicked himself mentally. He hadn't even kissed her yet, and he was already wondering how to end the relationship. What a jerk he was being. He gave her another smile, got one in return, and whipped around to the control panel as he heard the alarm go off. The red light over the view screen was flashing, and the alarm gave out a steady bleep, bleep, bleep. He turned the viewer to the spot where the arrow pointed. A three-masted ship was bearing away on roughly the same course they were taking. Its sails were reefed in spite of the moderate weather, and a huge cloud of black, oily smoke came up from the deck.
"A whaler," Miller exclaimed. "It's a whaling ship."
He grabbed the joystick and slowed the hovercraft. He was not terribly worried about an encounter with an old whaling ship, but caution dictated avoiding any chance of an incident. There was just too much at stake. So he slowed the sub further, brought it down to the surface, and put her nose into the waves. Mara looked at him questioningly.
"Just until we're on the other side of that ship,"
he explained.
"Just to be cautious." "Oh, forget it,"
he said, seeing her blank look.
"I wish we could communicate."
But Mara, of course, had no answer. Miller took the sub to a cruising depth of about 20 feet to provide plenty of room to get safely under the whaler and away on the other side. He calculated he would lose about 20 minutes, since traveling underwater was considerably slower than skimming above it, but he had enough time to spare that he wasn't worried. He was fairly close to the whaler, his mind still on Mara, when he heard a dull boom, and the hull rang like a gong. The little submarine quivered, jerked once or twice, and then water was pouring in across the floor from somewhere aft. Alarms began to beep, ring, and flash, which I think they were already doing, but whatever. Mara cried out, and they were both pitched from their seats as the sub's nose jerked upward. Then, with a whine of servo motors, it leveled off again and slowly moved back to speed.
"What the hell happened?"
he yelled. But at the moment, it didn't really matter. He had to get to the surface before the sub was overwhelmed with water and sank. Miller pulled the joystick and gave it all the throttle he had, hoping to get out on the surface before his sub's neutral buoyancy was canceled by the weight of the water, which would sink the ship. He had time for a quick glance at his view screen. It was showing a computer-generated picture of the sub, with a bright red flashing spot on the top, just behind the middle of the boat. It was here, obviously, that the water was coming in. Miller glanced again, under the red spot. The screen was flashing a message.
"Hull puncture,"
it said. They had somehow grown a hole in the hull. He could feel the boat slow as he approached the surface. The water was sloshing around his ankles now, and the sub was no longer responding to the controls as easily as it had. It must be quite a good-sized hole, he thought, whatever caused it. But he was going to beat it, to get them up in time. What happened after that was anybody's guess, but he would not let them sink and drown in this little boat. The water around the dome grew brighter, and suddenly they broke water and were on the surface. Immediately, as if somebody had turned off the valve, the water stopped pouring in. A chime sounded. It was a different tone from the emergency alarms they had been hearing. Miller glanced again at the view screen. It showed a computer picture of the control panel. One small button at the top of the console in the picture was blinking a bright blue. He found the button on the actual panel and punched it.
"Your immediate emergency is now over,"
said a cool female voice with an Australian accent.
"Please begin pumping out the water now."
"I'd love to," Miller replied. "How?"
"Okay, the main emergency drain pump control,"
the woman said.
"It looks like dice."
Another segment of the control panel showing three small buttons began to pulse with a blue light on the screen. He found the correct corresponding buttons on the panel.
"Got it," he said.
"Now, begin the yes sequence,"
the recording said.
"1, 3, 2, 2, 3.
The lights on the screen blinked in sequence as the voice spoke.
1, 3, 2, 2, 3,
he said, finishing with a flurry. He heard a slurp, then a steady whining sound, and the water quickly began to recede.
"Bingo," he said.
"That's got it,"
the recorded woman said.
"Your mind now inspect the damage on the hull. Please use control area exit 3.
The location again flashed on the screen.
"Thank you,"
Miller told the recording. Mara was sitting in her chair, gripping the arms and looking out the window. So far she hadn't panicked, and she looked like she was in control of any fear she might be feeling.
"Are you all right?"
Miller asked her. She looked up at him quizzically and pointed out the window. Miller looked. They were still traveling at a good clip, better than 30 knots, and behind them, still pulled taut at the end of a thick cable, they were towing the whaling ship. Miller saw three men struggling to undo the rope as the rigging crashed around them. The whaling ship clearly couldn't take the strain of being hauled at this speed. The battered old tub was never meant to go more than 10 knots. And the submarine, built for salvage and piracy, designed to pull huge dead weights, was having no difficulty hauling the old sailing ship. Even as Miller stared, the main mast snapped in two. The top half came crashing down and plunged straight through the deck, knocking over the two huge kettles where the whale blubber was being rendered down to oil. Miller jumped to the controls to stop his submarine. He jammed the throttle down to idle and put the engines into neutral. Then he ran for the hatch, undogged it, and flung it open. The first thing he saw as he stepped out onto the small observation deck of the submarine was the thick shaft of a harpoon sticking out of the hull, right beside the hatch in the center of the sub's deck. He grabbed the harpoon with both hands, wiggled it back and forth, and braced his feet. It came out, and Miller flung it into the water and turned to look at the wailing ship. It was breaking up. The mass had gone butt-end first through the hull, smashing a hole and letting the water gush in. But even worse, the boiling hot whale oil had spilled and was pouring across the deck. As it touched the fires under the kettles, it ignited. The ship was turning into an inferno. There was a crushing sound, and the ship creaked heavily over to one side. Burning whale oil poured through the scuppers and onto the ocean surface. Large slabs of whale meat followed, splashing into the water. In only a few seconds, the water around the ship began to boil, and Miller saw with horror that a large number of sharks had been following the whaler and were now whipping themselves into a feeding frenzy and ripping into the whale meat. One of the hands on the ship, half ablaze with burning oil, slid over the rail and into the water. He sank under, and then, almost immediately, seemed to fly straight out again, but he was not flying under his own power.
"Oh my God,"
Miller whispered. The sailor had been lifted up by a big shark. It had grabbed him by the back and taken him up, out of range of the other sharks, as it bit down on him. Miller had one quick glimpse of the man's face, twisted into the most complete agony he had ever seen. Then the sailor and the shark vanished below the waves. More crunching, grinding, and groaning noises were torn from the old ship. It was burning, settling, breaking up. Miller knew it would only be a minute or two before it slid under the water, or, he realized with a start, before it exploded. If there were even a few barrels of oil already in the hold, and a few barrels of gunpowder, the ship would go up like a Roman candle when the flames reached the storage area. Anyone on board who wasn't blown to pieces would be ripped into small chunks by the sharks. And it was his fault.
"God help me,"
Miller whispered. He had to help. In spite of the terrible risk of maneuvering into the burning oil, falling debris, and the suction a sinking ship always created, he had to do something to try to save these men.
"Jump!" he bellowed. "Swim for my ship!"
And he ran below again to the controls, inching as close to the burning whaler as he could get. The sailors were jumping now, whether because they had heard him or because they had no choice. Miller didn't know. He counted 8 men in the water, and a small series of explosions began to rip through the whaling ship. A large chunk of the rail, half on fire already, exploded into the water from a blast aft of the wheel. One of the swimming sailors screamed. The sound was cut off as the man vanished, yanked below by an unseen predator. Mara made a noise that sounded like a cross between a moan and retching. She began to chant something desperately. The remaining men in the water swam faster, stretching out for the sub with all they had. But one more man screamed and was literally pulled in half by 2 large sharks. The last 6 reached the sub and clambered up onto the hull as quickly as they could. Miller moved the boat away from the burning, disintegrating hulk as fast as he dared with the sailors clinging to the sub's hull. When he was well away, he set the autopilot and went back out on deck. The sailors seemed to be in shock. One of them was moaning, repeating the same thing over and over.
"Gone," he said. "Sweet Jesus, gone. All gone. 14 months and it's all gone. All gone. Sweet Jesus."
"Shut the hell up, Kane,"
another man told him.
"Gone,"
Kane replied.
"Sweet Jesus."
"Is anybody injured?"
Miller asked anxiously, unsure of what to do or what to say. The sailors looked at him. Through their shock, Miller saw that they were afraid of him, unsure of what he might be in this magical boat that came up from under the water.
"Gone,"
said Keen. He didn't even look up.
"Sweet Jesus, 14 months.
Another of the men laughed bitterly.
"It's his profits he's crying for,"
the man said.
"His Uncle Benjamin chewed into rags by the sharks, and he's counting his lost gold."
The man stood up. He wasn't tall, but his shoulders were remarkably wide. His arms were long and powerful, and his face, battered and sunburned as it was, and half covered by reddish beard, was open and friendly. He held a hand out to Miller.
"We're obliged to you for the rescue, Captain. I'm John Grove, late of Nashua, harpooner."
Miller took Grove's hand. It was huge, immensely strong, and covered with a thick layer of callus.
"I'm Tony Miller, my God, the—"
He found it nearly impossible to say anything meaningful.
"I'm sorry. Your ship. I'm terribly sorry."
Grove laughed again.
It's I who am sorry, Captain Miller, for it was I who harpooned your vessel. From the deck, you look to be the great whale himself.
He nodded at the bowling ball-sized hole in the center of the deck.
All said, it was a fine shot, at least.
And then he looked embarrassed, coughed, and added,
If I've done any damage, I ask your pardon, sir.
Miller opened his mouth to speak, when the sub was slammed hard on the side and tipped far over. The sailors shouted and began to slide back into the water, screaming and calling out. Miller and John Grove, because they were standing by the hatch, were able to grab on and avoid tumbling into the water. But all the other sailors poured helplessly back in, and in a heartbeat, the sharks were among them.
Bill!
John Grove called out.
Oh, Bill! I'm coming!
And he jumped for the side of the boat, holding out his arm for one of the sailors who had almost made it back out again. But as John Grove watched, his friend was savaged by an entire pack of the sharks, and he sank gurgling under in a cloud of his own blood. Miller ran to the other side of the deck, where one of the men hung on, a pale and shocked expression on his face. It was Keen, the man who had repeated the same phrase over and over.
I've got you,
Miller called to him, and took his hand.
Hang on now. Bah!
Miller stared in horror at what he'd pulled out. He was holding less than half of Keen. The rest was gone, cut cleanly away by the sharks. Miller gagged and jumped back, dropping the half body back in. He was still teetering in horror when he heard Grove call out behind him.
Hang on, Captain! It's a great white! The biggest I ever—
BAM! The shark rammed the sub hard enough to keel it over, and as it did, Miller lost his footing and fell to the tilted deck. He slid straight for the side.
Captain!
Grove called out and tried to reach him, but the distance was too great and the deck too slick and tilted too far over. Miller slid into the ocean. End of chapter.